Happy Sunday. We're going to take a look again at the book of Ecclesiastes. We're going to dive into Ecclesiastes chapter 2 today as part of our teaching series called Wisdom and Passion out of Ecclesiastes and the book of Psalms. As I said last week, Ecclesiastes is an Old Testament book of wisdom. It's written by this mysterious figure called Kohelet in Hebrew, or the teacher in English. Some people think it's Solomon, but we're not sure. And you get the impression, if you read the book in its entirety, that if the writer of Ecclesiastes was alive today, he'd probably be wearing all black and smoking clove cigarettes and listening to My Chemical Romance music and doom-scrolling his way through the internet, because he's this total Debbie Downer-sounding figure. That's what you get when you read the book of Ecclesiastes. But I love that it's in the Bible because it's so honest. Look what this writer, Kohelet, writes in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. So he's a pleasure seeker. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, that's just madness. And what does pleasure even accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And remember, meaningless means it's a vapor. It's just going to be gone. Nothing was gained under the sun. I hated my life. That's basically what he's saying. Because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And the last two verses. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own work. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? So in this chapter, the writer of Ecclesiastes is looking back on his life and all the things he did in order to try to have a full and meaningful life. He tried to achieve this through pleasure, achievements, and wealth. He had the world, but he still felt empty inside, and he gets exasperated and basically says, I hate my life. I think he felt like the girl on the back of this bike. Okay, let's put that up. That's what I think he felt like. I seriously do. When I saw that picture, I go, that's how the writer of Ecclesiastes feels like. Oh, I hate my life right now. We've all had times when we felt like that. Maybe if we're being honest, you feel like that today, like you hate your life. But here's the good news. In the midst of this rant that he makes here, the teacher actually shows us some things that will help us to lead full and meaningful lives. If he would have done them, this little Debbie Downer guy would have started dancing again. Thus the title of my message. So let's take a look at some things that we can do that set us along the path to a long and to a full and meaningful life. Hopefully it'll be long. First thing, do things for others. In verses 4 through 7, the teacher focuses on all his achievements, the great things he had done. And he'd done a lot. He built houses. He planted vineyards. He made gardens and parks. He owned a lot of livestock. He created reservoirs. Who does that? Who gets up like on a Monday and goes, what should I do today? I'm going to make a reservoir, okay? But he did that, and yet he felt empty. And it's easy to see why, because if you read his words closely, you realize he did all of these things for himself. He wasn't thinking of others. He wasn't serving others. In fact, he was using others, because he talks about all the slaves that he owned. We will always feel empty when we are using people instead of serving them. Always. But when we serve people, wow, our hearts and lives fill up with joy and meaning and blessing, because that's how God wired it. As you know, a team of us went to Alaska for the second year in a row, some of us went, and we served the some of the tribal people, the indigenous tribal people on the Kenai Peninsula, who live in pretty bad circumstances most of the time, especially some of the tribal elders. And here's a picture of us, and here's some of the tribal elders that we invited to a barbecue. These three, this is Robert and Troy Ann and Colette, all 4'8", 4'10", and 6 foot of him. Okay, so those girls are short, all right? Well, we did all kinds of stuff when we were there. We repaired apartments. We reorganized food pantries. We stuffed backpacks for some of the tribal kids. We painted. We split and stacked wood. My wife did a lot of that. We did all these things. We did yard work in the middle of a monsoon. Yesterday, how hard it rained. It flooded in Alaska because it rained that hard for 2.5 days. I mean, it was just constant. We were exhausted. We were emptied of energy, but our hearts were full. Our hearts are full. I know I speak for the people on the team. We felt so alive in the process of serving people. You don't have to go to Alaska to serve. You can serve people anywhere, anytime, any place. Please do. You'll empty your body of energy. It won't be easy, but you'll fill your heart and your life with joy, with meaning, with fullness. So that's the first thing we do. You want to have a full life, you can serve others. The second thing, enjoy your work. Now, stay with me here. In verses 10 through 20 and 24, the teacher talks about enjoying his work. Some of you find that quite easy to do. You actually love your work. Even if you're retired, you love what you're doing. It's quite natural for you. God bless you. I'm in the same boat. I love, love, love being a pastor. Some of you think that it's impossible to enjoy your work because you hate, hate, hate your work. And even if, when I mention work, you're already dreading going to work tomorrow. You have Ursula the Sea Witch as your boss. You hate what you're doing. It just feels like an empty, dead-end job. I can't give you a formula that will magically help you love your job in 3 easy steps, but I can tell you one thing that I know will help, because it's helped me in some of my past employments that I didn't enjoy. And it's 2 words: notice God. In Ecclesiastes, no matter how much griping the teacher does, no matter how much calamity and unfairness he sees in the world, he also sees God, he notices God. And one of the main messages in the book of Ecclesiastes is this: God is here, God is all entangled up in our lives. I will say this, I've said it before to you, and I will say it as long as I'm a pastor. We do not, like some people think, we do not have to wait to experience God in some faraway place, in some distant time in the afterlife. We can very much experience God right here, right now, in this life, because God is with us always, even in the most surprising places, at funerals, in hospital rooms, during sleepless nights, in bad jobs, and in proctology appointments. And I said that on purpose, okay? Because I want to tell you about a guy that had a proctology appointment, and he realized that he can experience God literally anywhere. His name is Rabbi Bradley Artson. And a few years ago, he was having a lot of pain in his nether regions, okay? So he went to see a proctologist. We, right? Because no good day starts with the sentence, "I'm going to see my proctologist today." Like, no good day starts that way. He got there and he was told he had a rare and potentially life-threatening condition called histiocytosis X. Histiocytosis X. Doesn't that sound ominous? And then he was also diagnosed with diabetes, but not just diabetes, diabetes insipidus. I mean, those are the 2 worst sounding diseases I think I've ever heard. And he talks about his life, the diagnosis that he received, the fear, the medication, the treatments. And he said all of it led him to hitting absolute rock bottom in his life. He was at his wit's end. Look what he said when he got to rock bottom. "I had descended as far as I could go, and there was God, just in time. There is nothing in the world, no moment in time, no place, no created event that is not marinating in God." Wow. God is present everywhere. and anywhere, even at rock bottom, even in the job that we hate. Learn to notice God there. I mean, think about your job. God is there. God is there in the customers you serve. God is there in the friendships you're making with your coworkers. God is there in the patience you are developing by having to deal with that particular boss that you work for. God is there in the worth that you feel as God reminds you of who you truly are, even though on a weekly basis at work, your self-image takes a beating. God is there in the compassion you feel for people on the fringes of society, the forgotten people, because that's how you feel every day at work, like you're on the fringe, you're not accepted, you're forgotten. God is there in the gentle reminder you hear when somebody's being a upper thigh hole to you that you don't have to pass that hurt and pain along. And God is even present in the courage you might one day experience to quit that job and get a job that doesn't pay as much, but that you love going to. Yeah, may we be all be the kind of people who are on the look for God, a God who shows up in the most surprising places, even bad jobs. And the last thing we can do that takes us on the path to a full and meaningful life is be a joy monger. In verses 24 through 25, right in the midst of his exasperation, the teacher tells people to realize that joy can still be available to you. In fact, in the original language this verse was written in, these verses were written in Hebrew, it says that we are invited to bring forth joy. I thought, bring forth joy, how do we do that? And then I thought about it, well, one thing we can do is know where joy is located. You want to bring forth joy in your life? You better know where to find it. Many people, I've ran across this as a pastor so often, many people try so hard, they try really, really hard to be happy, joyful people, and then they end up more miserable than ever. It's like the harder they try, the more miserable they make themselves. And part of this, I think, is because they are thinking wrong about the location of joy. In their mind, they think joy is only located in those magical moments in our life where everything's lined up right and you have the perfect job and your kids are being perfect, at least for a minute or two, and you're getting along with everybody and you have no problems. And those moments just don't happen very often in our life. That's not reality. And so they think, oh, when the stuff goes wrong, I can't have joy. So off to Grumpyville they go. Joy, true joy, is not just located in the times where there's no sorrow or pain or hardship in our life. It's located when there is sorrow and pain and hardship in our life. Don't listen to what Instagram tells you, because true joy is actually located on the other side of those things. That's why the most joyful people you've ever met in your life are always the people that have endured a lot of hardship in their life, every single time. They haven't had magical pain-free lives. They've gotten through stuff. The message of Ecclesiastes is this: you will bring forth joy in your life when you stop trying to avoid pain and sorrow and hardship. That's one of the messages of Ecclesiastes. So instead of trying to avoid those things, go into the heart of your sorrow. Go into the heart of your sadness, into the heart of your trouble and loss. Go all the way into it, and on the other side, you will discover joy. I want to put a comma there for a second. I'll come back to that. But I want to talk to you about a really cool and really big Greek word. I'm going to geek out on the Bible once again, okay? It's found in these verses. I'm going to read them. Ephesians chapter 1. He made known to us, God did, the mystery of his will according to his good pleasure, which he purposed in Christ to be put into effect when the times reached their fulfillment, to bring unity, or to sum up, all things in heaven and earth under Christ. Okay, that phrase to sum up or bring all things together is this gigantic Greek word that I'll put on the screen behind me. Yeah, try pronouncing that. It's anakephala eosestai. I nailed it. Practiced all week for that moment right there, okay? This word doesn't mean just to sum up all things, okay? It means to recapitulate. It has layers of meaning. It also means to recapitulate or retell. Now, stay with me. This is where it gets cool, and I owe this insight to one of my favorite authors. Think of your own life. When you go through any kind of a memorable situation in your life, the first thing you want to do is retell the story of that situation or that occurrence to one of your family members or loved ones. And when you retell it, you don't leave anything out. You include all the nasty, unfortunate, hurtful bits. For example, when we were in Alaska, Troy Ann, all 4'10" of her that was in the picture, I always ask the tribal elders about their lives and listen to their stories, because they lived in Seward, where there was an 8-point-something, you know, earthquake. What do you call that on the Richter scale? 8.4 or something like that. And a third of their town just washed out to sea in the tsunami. But they've also had amazing experiences with animals. So I always ask them when we have dinner, what are your bear stories? What are your moose stories? What are your eagle stories? What are your fish stories? And they always have amazing ones. And Troy Ann had it. She goes, I got a moose story for you. Okay, let's have it, Troy Ann. She goes, her husband, who died shortly before we got there, it was so sad. She was still in the grieving process. But she goes, one day we heard a ruckus out in our yard, and my husband went out to investigate. And he goes around the corner, and all of a sudden I'm inside, and I hear an even greater ruckus, and there's yelling and screaming outside. So I go, and she's got a big front like picture window, and she looks out the window just in time to see an enormous moose. And all moose are enormous, by the way. If you haven't seen a moose in real life, they are gymongous animals, okay? And they're mean. They're mean little things. I mean, being big things. And she saw this moose, and it was rearing up and stomping down. That's a bad sign, because that's how they trample people to death. So she's afraid, but her husband makes his way into the house somehow. He's an older guy in his 60s, and his glasses are on sideways, and he's bleeding in his shoulder pretty badly, and he's disheveled. She goes, oh, we got to get you to the hospital, and he just shakes his head, no. No, we got to get you to the hospital. You're hurt. You're bleeding. No. And then he makes his way. He goes back outside, and she's going, what are you doing? He goes back outside and comes in a short time later with his false teeth. Because the moose hit him so hard in the shoulder, it popped his teeth out of his mouth. Now, she included the part about the false teeth in his story. It would have been a bummer at the time, especially for him. Not only was his shoulder hurt, but he knocked his teeth out. That's so humiliating. But in retelling the story, the bad part becomes the best part. All of us are going to go through situations in our lives that are sad, heartbreaking, or just flat awful. But God has this way of helping us to look back at our lives and retell the stories with great joy, even the bad parts. But let me say this. Some of the bad parts in our lives will bring joy, because in retelling them, the absurdity of the moment is funny. I get that, just like Troy Ann's story. But some of the moments in some of our lives are so awful, they will never be funny. But you can still retell them with joy. Let me explain. Because those moments weren't funny, but we survived them. We became more compassionate people because of them. We became more forgiving because of those bad moments. We became more courageous because of them. And that will bring us a very real and very deep sense of joy. It's not funny, but it's still joy. So let's be people who know where joy is located. It's not located just in the absence of sorrow and hardship. It's located on the other side of that. I have been quoting some poetry to you lately, and I'm going to do it again. This is a quote from the ancient mystic poet Rumi. Look what he says about this. Sorrow prepares you for joy. It violently sweeps everything out of your house so that new joy can find space to enter. It shakes the yellow leaves from the bough of your heart so that fresh green leaves can grow in their place. It pulls up the rotten roots so that new roots hidden beneath have room to grow. Whatever sorrow shakes from your heart, far better things will take their place. That's incredible. So I'm going to leave this up here after the service, and you can write it down if you want. That's incredible. But here's an added bonus to being the kind of person who locates joy on the other side of hardship and joy, or hardship and sorrow. I want to quote a song. It was popular a year and a half ago. It's called 100 Bad Days Song. And he sings, when all is going wrong and you're scared as hell, what are you going to do? Who are you going to tell? maybe 100 bad days made 100 good stories, and 100 good stories make me interesting at parties. Is that not just the best side benefit of locating joy on the opposite side of hardship and sorrow? You become interesting at parties just like you always wanted to be. I've talked long enough today, so sorry. Gene's going to come up and lead us in a spiritual practice today that helps us put the words of these scriptures into motion in our lives. Then after that, Maria will end us with just two short announcements.
It's just amazing to me that the book of Ecclesiastes is in the Bible. I love it. It's an example of how the Bible has to have a lot of truth in it, because if they were just trying to write something, you know, to make it sound good, they wouldn't have included Ecclesiastes. Here's my take. Ecclesiastes is, to me, like a memoir or maybe some journal excerpts from a guy who totally won at life the way they thought winning at life worked. And after he had done that, he realized, that's not what it's all cut up to be. And how could he have not? Because that's the way the world works, right? Paul calls it the spirit of the power of the air. There's just a way of thinking that happens in the world that can draw us to the outside, to the periphery, to the circumference of our lives, to things that really don't matter, and away from the core of our life. So, the writer of Ecclesiastes tried to attain a meaningful life by working more, we saw in the verses that we read, playing more, relaxing more, having more, achieving more. That's one of the big things that our world lures us into. If only I had more of this, more of that. Another thing the world leads us into is thinking that it's really all about me. In these 26 verses in this chapter, the words I or me occur 30 times. I tried, I looked, I acquired, I sought. It's all about me. I. And it's as if the writer didn't even realize that just about every other sentence he started with the word I. You know, it's like, get over yourself. But how can we not feel that way? Because our culture is so always talking about, you know, what I can do, who I can be. So the question is not today, how can I have a meaningful life? But what is a meaningful life? The writer of Ecclesiastes was living on the circumference of his life. Here's what the Apostle Paul says about that. Whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, and Paul had just listed all these ways that he had won at life, the way he thought winning at life was to be interpreted. And he goes, what is more, I consider everything, all of that, a loss because of surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them garbage, that I may gain Christ and be found in him. So a meaningful life is one that's lived from the center, so the image of God can be reflected in our behavior. Paul later writes to Timothy, command those who are rich in this present world, those who are winning at life, the way winning is defined around most of our lives, those who are rich in the present world, not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, like we've heard about in several cases this morning, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. The life that is truly life. So, here's our practice. We want to do a simple exercise that we can maybe do every now and then. I do this sort of thing often, usually when I'm out in my garden, that will help us to let go of those things that we have been trying to cling to win at life. to let go of those things. And let's be honest, it's hard. We're surrounded by so many influences, Instagram and Facebook and all of that. Our celebrity worship, where we think, if only I could have a life like that. We're surrounded by these things that make us want to cling to these things on the outer edge of our lives. It takes a concerted effort. It takes intentionality to say, you know what? Those things are gifts from God for our enjoyment, but they are not what life is all about. I am going to let go. How can I experience what Paul called being renewed by the transforming of our minds? How can I experience that? Well, simple contemplative practices like this can help. So here we go. Let's begin just by stilling ourselves, taking in a few deep breaths and exhaling nice and deep and slow. And each time we breathe in for a while, be thinking these words, I put my hope in you. I put my hope in you and not in achieving more. I put my hope in you and not in acquiring more. I put my hope in you and not in playing more. I put my hope in you and not in just relaxing more. I put my hope in you so that you can live your life through me. I put my hope in you so that I may take hold of the life that is truly life. Dear God, this week as we go about our days, in our volunteering, our working, our playing, our resting, help us to not be drawn away to the outside of our lives by those things that you have freely given us as good gifts. Rather, may those things reflect us back to the center of our lives, to you, to the core of our being, to the image of God. We put our hope in you. Amen.